I'd like you to picture in your mind a six-year-old girl. It's not a very difficult task. You might have a six-year-old daughter yourself, or a granddaughter, or a niece, or someone, a little sister. Think about a six-year-old girl. Give her light brown hair and blue-green eyes. Make her German. And imagine that the year is 1505. By her family name, von Bora, we know that she came from minor nobility. One of her father's ancestors had been a knight in the Holy Roman Empire, and this ensured that she was part of the aristocracy of her day. But that was a mixed blessing, because it provided a certain level of privilege and stature in society. In many ways, it was empty, because her family had been poor for many, many years. Her father was a land-owning farmer, and he enjoyed some level of respect because of his name and his family heritage. But he had no money, he had no financial reserves, and really he lived a subsistence lifestyle from week to week, from year to year. His survival and the survival of his family depended on the success of the crops each year, that wars and battles were fought far away, and that terrible diseases or accidents didn't strike him or his family. Well, this little six-year-old girl was named Katerina von Bora, but we'll call her Katie this afternoon. She grew up in the midst of real difficulty and disappointment to become a famous and important woman, the wife of Martin Luther, and it's worth our time to think about her and learn about her. But before we go any further, I want to try to set the stage for you. I think it's really important when we do biographies to think about the past and what life in the past was like. Because Katie lived in a completely different world to the world in which we live. And we must be careful not to think about what we know of life and transfer it back to the year 1505. So I'm asking, and I hope to answer the question, what was life like in Katie's day? Well, in many ways, it depends on who you are. Are you male or female? Where did you live? In a city? In a town? In a village? On a farm in the country? Were you in the peasant class, the lowest class, a serf? Were you in the yeoman class, the merchant class? Was your father a gentleman? Were you part of the gentry, the upper levels of society? Or were you part of nobility? Your life would be very different depending on the status of your family. Let's talk about some specifics. First, religion. Religion, to a large degree, depended on when you lived as well as on where you lived. If you lived in Europe prior to about the year 1520, you can argue with me over that date afterwards, but prior to about 1520, virtually everyone in Europe was Roman Catholic. Unless you were Jewish, you were Roman Catholic. Everyone was Roman Catholic. After approximately 1520, even if you lived in Saxony, which is where Wittenberg was, where Luther was working and serving, even if you lived in Saxony, you might still be Roman Catholic, because Saxony was divided into two parts. North Saxony was ruled by Frederick the Wise, and it became Lutheran. South Saxony was ruled by his brother, Duke George, and it was Roman Catholic. So it depended on where you lived, whether or not you were exposed to the gospel. What about life expectancy and mortality? Now, we're talking about a six-year-old girl. Average life expectancy in 1505 was the mid-30s. So I died 30 years ago. Mortality rates, up to 50% of the population died before reaching age 20. All right, now imagine 10 six-year-old girls, and one of them is Katie. She's surrounded by 9 of her friends. By the time that she reaches 20, 5 of her friends would be dead. Half of them would already be gone. Now, if you made it to age 20, you could expect to live into your 50s, and longer lives were not uncommon. You could occasionally find someone who was in their 60s or 70s or even 80s, sometimes even into their 90s, but that was very unusual. Infant mortality is very interesting. Contrary to expectations, infants, the mortality rate was lower in the lower classes and higher in the higher classes. We read oftentimes biographies of the people who are well known and of the death of their children, but statistics tell us that the serf classes, children were more likely to survive than those in the more wealthy classes. Now, you might ask why. We don't really know. But one suggestion is that in the lower classes, mothers were more likely to breastfeed and be close to their own babies, where in the upper classes, they often hired someone to come in and take care of the babies, and those who were hired were not so solicitous of the well-being of the children as were the mothers of their own children. It's a theory that makes sense, but it's only a theory. What about health? By the time you were 20 years old, you probably will have lost all or most of your teeth. You probably would have been subject to any number of difficult diseases or conditions. Many of them have been wiped out. We don't think of them any longer. A disease called rickets, which is a softening of the bones in childhood, smallpox, ringworm, or plague, frequently called the Black Death. In London, in the year 1665 to 66, I realize that's about 150 years later than we're talking about, but there was an outbreak of the plague in London. London had a population of about 300,000 people, and 60,000 of them died in the course of the plague. That's one out of every five residents died because of the plague. That's what it was like. If you broke a bone, you were probably maimed for life. The only analgesic that could be used to help relieve your pain was excessive alcohol. That's all that was available. You couldn't go to the closet and take Tylenol, nor anything stronger to help you. That's it. If you had a condition that required treatment by a physician, I want to say don't go. Because you would probably have leeches applied to your body, or you would be bled. They would open up one of your veins. And that was based on the theory that your body consisted of four humors: yellow bile, black bile, blood, and phlegm, and that they were out of balance. And so they would take out the blood to help put your body back into balance. Now, all of us know better than that today, right? We need blood. Don't take away blood in the midst of a disease or some such condition. You might be prescribed by one of the doctors of the day a wonderful substance like mercury, or even worse, arsenic. It was known to have been on the curative list. Well, doctor, I don't feel well today. Well, my friend, why don't you take some arsenic? You'll feel better in heaven. Going back to the 17th century, Richard Baxter, you know his name, he seemed to have had a problem with chronic indigestion. I wonder if it's acid reflux that we would call it today. But he was told, he was prescribed to take a golden bullet to help him with his digestion. I don't know what it looked like. A golden bullet. So he did. And his autobiography says that he spent several days in agony until he was able to pass the golden bullet. Medicine was to a large degree barbaric. One suspects that more people died from treatment than were healed. That's how bad it was. There was no real sense of hygiene, and so you were subject to all kinds of airborne and waterborne toxins. Sanitation is virtually non-existent. Luther writes of his children using the corners of rooms as toilets. Human waste was cast into the street and left to be washed away by the next rain. Dead bodies of animals were left to rot or to be picked over by carrion. Imagine the rats and the fleas and the lice and the fleas. Water was unsanitary. Dysentery was common and often deadly. Everyone would have had bad breath and body odor. The upper classes applied all kinds of perfumes to cover the stench. Showers were unknown. Baths were unavailable only to those who were wealthy. One time when Katie returned home from church, she said, "It was so full it stank." And Luther said, "They had manure on their boots." I'm glad that Heritage smells better than that. Now, what about your home? We all live in nice homes. If you lived on a farm, you would probably have a small house with wood and mud walls, with a dirt floor and thatch on the roof. Outside, there might be several small barns or outbuildings. All of the family members probably slept together in the same room, and oftentimes along with some of their animals who would be brought in because there was no place to put the animals at night. And so the animals are there, and their refuse would have made an awful presence in the room with husband and wife and all the children. In towns or in cities, housing was scarce. For the poorest, it might be nothing more than a wood frame covered in paper. Chalk was cheaper than stucco. Brick was the building material for the rich. In the towns and the cities, roofs would have been made of thatch or tile. We were having a little joke at lunchtime about food. By the way, the food today was excellent. Thank you, ladies. The staple of many diets in Europe was meat or fish, and perhaps some sort of bread. I think about this, and I think they had sort of a keto diet. I realize the bread didn't work with the keto diet, but largely they ate fish and meat. There was no cold storage, of course, for meat, so it was seldom fresh and appetizing. It could be rancid or moldy or worse. You basically didn't throw it away. You used it, no matter how bad it was. There were ways that they worked around meat going bad. Fresh vegetables and fruit were highly restricted, seasonal, and they could be very expensive. It's very difficult for us to imagine the joy of first fruits or the harvest festival. You had to eat it while it was fresh and while it was abundant. I can remember even when I was a kid, I would say to my mother, could we have such and such? And she'd say, it's not that time of year. It's not available. It's not like that anymore, isn't it? You can go to any grocery store and get anything that you want to at any time of the year because it's flown in. But back then, when harvest time came, you enjoyed the fresh fruit and you enjoyed the fresh vegetable, and all the rest of the year you waited for harvest time to come around again so that you could enjoy them one more time. They weren't there. They weren't available. Along the same lines, imagine what cuisine must have been like in January, in the middle of winter. Water tended to be polluted, and they knew this, so beer and ale and wine were common beverages. Most of the population lived on a sustenance diet. And a great question that every family had to face was this: could the country produce enough grain and vegetables and food for the need of the population? Because drought and pestilence had very serious consequences for many. If it was a year of drought, many people would die simply because the crops could not grow. Clothing. If you were a serf, you probably wore the same clothes every day, even to bed, for month upon month at a time. As social status moved upward, more choices were available, but luxuries were truly luxuries, available only to a few. What language would you speak? Now, German was the common language, but it must be understood as dialectical German. Colloquialisms were widespread, as were divergences of accent and pronunciation. Even today, if you go to Europe, there are dialects of German. There's Swiss German, which differs from Hochdeutsch, High German, which is spoken in Germany. It was really Luther's translation of the Bible that provided standardization of the German language. Prior to that, there were all kinds of versions of German. Likewise, provincialism. You might be born and live and die and never travel beyond the borders of your county. Your life would center on your family, perhaps a walk once a week to market day in the market town. Market day was an important day, and it would have given you the best opportunity to be exposed to something greater than your routine of life. But for the most part, your world would have been very, very small. Even for me, I live less than 3 miles from the church. It would have been a long walk for me to be able to come to church. Those of us who live further away, you wouldn't have been able to attend this kind of a church. It would have taken you all day to get here. Travel was very difficult. And for much of the population, it was impossible. The poor had to walk. Maybe a horse would be available if you're a little bit better off. But you were always in danger of highwaymen, robbers. And travelers oftentimes, if they were able to do so, would choose to take a sea route rather than a land route because of the dangers of traveling cross-country. Literacy. Literacy varied from country to city, and it was largely a male domain. Women among the nobility would have been sent to convents, and that'll take on some importance in a few moments. Women among the nobility would have been sent to converts to be instructed in reading and in the womanly arts, that is, keeping the house. But education, to a large degree, depended on a family's economic well-being. Most farmers couldn't hire workers, and thus they could not spare their children from regular labors on the farm, and so these children tended to be raised without any kind of formal education. And then women. For women, life could be very grim, and we'll see why. Marriage in the upper classes were arranged during youth, often for the sake of social standing, not for love. In the lower classes, life depended on marriage, even continued marriage, because widowhood and becoming an orphan, losing your parents, especially losing your father, could bring terrible poverty. Now, that's just a sample of life in 1505 in Katie's era. Would you like to live there? Not me. I'm fascinated by the 16th and 17th centuries, but I sure am glad that I live when I do and not then. That if I have a toothache, I can take a Tylenol and get some relief from it, or anything else in terms of modern conveniences. Thanks be to God. Now, let's come back to six-year-old Katie von Bora. She's the daughter of a noble family. She's proud but poor. She has three brothers and one sister. And at the age of six, she faces two or three great crises that would already to begin to shape her life. The first one, she's 6 years old, her mother died. We don't know why. Was it in childbirth? Was it some kind of disease? We simply don't know. But what does the death of a mother do to a six-year-old? And I wonder, what did she think? What did she feel when that news came that Mama was dead? The second thing that came while she was six is that her father remarried. And he married a woman of similar rank who had several children of her own. And suddenly, the von Boras had many mouths to feed. And based upon what happens next, one wonders if her stepmother didn't want her in the house at all. Because the third crisis, worst of all, was that six-year-old Katie von Bora was sent to live in a convent that was located more than 2 days' ride on a wooden cart away from her home. What did she feel? What was it like sitting in that cart, being pulled along a path next to her father or with her father, riding for 2 days, plodding along the road, and suddenly to be left in a strange place with people she does not know? Is that traumatic for a six-year-old? Now, you know, we have to think in terms of that distance was different back then to what it is today. 60 miles is probably about a 2-day ride. It's not very far for us. We can drive there in an hour. But think about it in these terms. 2-day drive from here in our cars would be Los Angeles or Chicago or New York. Imagine taking a 6-year-old girl to Los Angeles or Chicago or New York and dropping her off at a convent with people that she doesn't know and has never met before. What would that be like? In fact, for the next 18 years, the convent was the only life that Katie would know. A closed society, mostly of women. That's all she knew. The first convent, called Brena, it functioned for her as a school. Because she was a daughter of lesser nobility, she had the opportunity to receive a basic education. And she received that in the first couple of years that she was in the Brena convent. But about 5 years later, her father returned, and he took her another 65 miles away, another 2 days' ride, and placed her in a convent that's known as Mary's Throne. Mary's Throne Convent becomes very important for our story. She's about 10 years old. And when she's placed in Mary's Throne Convent, she becomes a postulant. Now, the word postulant is the word that's used to describe a girl who is taking the first step towards becoming a nun. You enter into sort of an early apprenticeship. So a postulant, I think in The Sound of Music, when Maria goes to the convent, she's a postulant at first. So you've heard that word before. That's what it refers to. Katie becomes a postulant in Mary's Throne Monastery. Now we might ask the question, why this change? Why did her father move her from Brena to Mary's Throne? Well, the simple answer is money. Monasteries and convents were big businesses in the late Middle Ages. They provided an important role in life and in society. We have to pause to think about the role that was played by monasteries and convents in the, here we are at the beginning of the 16th century. The Roman Catholic system, and I'm making a generalization here, was a system that required you to work your way to heaven. Okay, it began with grace. Baptism brings grace into the heart, but you have to follow up on that grace that God has given to you by earning your way to heaven by means of the seven sacraments and your obedience and all the rest. But when you must work your way to heaven and you don't have the time or the interest to do it, you need someone to perform these works for you. And that's what monks and nuns did. They lived your spiritual life for you. The monks in the monastery would devote their time to saying masses for the dead and for the living. If you had money, you could pay that Father so-and-so would say a mass on behalf of the soul of your dearly departed. And the more that you paid, the more benefit that it brought to your dearly departed. So you were buying your dearly departed's way out of purgatory and into heaven. And the monasteries made lots and lots of money because people were willing, because they love their dearly departed, they were willing to give up their money to find a way to get them to heaven. That's what the monks did. Of course, the nuns weren't priests, and so they couldn't say mass, but they could spend their time praying for the dead and for the living. And so you would pay the nuns in the monastery to do your spiritual work and pray for the souls of those that you loved. And it was big business, because you paid for your salvation and for the salvation of your loved ones. That's what money did. It brought salvation. Now, in order for the monasteries and the convents to function, they required lots and lots of money in order to survive. And part of the reason for that is that the religious, and religious there is a technical word that means monks and nuns. They were devoted to a religious life. They didn't do any kind of manual labor. They prayed, they observed mass, and they contemplated. That's what they did. They didn't work in the fields. They didn't provide any means by which income could come to the monastery. And so they needed to find a way to make some money. If you were to place your child in a monastery or in a convent, you had to pay. And most of the time, the monks and the nuns were from the higher classes. The way it usually worked was this. If you had sons, firstborn son, the law of primogeniture said he inherited from you. You even see that if you've watched Downton Abbey. They need a male heir in order to be able to carry on the Crawley family line. That's a recent adaptation of an ancient practice. The first son would be the heir. The second son typically would be sent to the church, would take up a role in the priesthood. The third son would be put into some kind of merchant responsibility, set up in business. And oftentimes it was foreign business, especially in the Levant, which is more or less Turkey. Lots of foreign business. Third sons were put into that to bring money back into the family in that way. Well, daughters couldn't inherit at all. So unless they were married off to someone in the aristocracy, you'd send them to convents, but you'd have to pay to put them into the convent. Now, Katie's first convent, when she was 6 years old, the Brena Convent, was very expensive. My analogy is being sent there was like being sent to an Ivy League school. Top dollar that you pay to be in Brina. But the second convent, Mary's Throne, was much cheaper for her father. It was like going to community college. That's how different they were in terms of cost. And so he placed her there at Mary's Throne in order to save the family a whole lot of money. Now, there was a bonus in that there were already two relatives who were nuns in Mary's Throne Convent. But as we said, this was a step down. Think about this. First 6 years in what seems to be a happy home. Her mother dies. Now she's sent off to a wealthy abbey. Then at age 10, she's taken to a poor abbey. And this Mary's Throne Abbey was set in a valley away from a town. It had hidden gates, but on the hidden gates was a sign that said in German, off limits. So there she was, with no choice to the contrary. In 1514, at the age of 15, she became a novice. And in 1515, at age 16, she took her three vows, the vow of obedience, the vow of poverty, and the vow of chastity. That was October the 8th, 1515. Now, I have a question. Any of you teenage girls like to be a nun? I don't see any hands going up right now. I don't blame you. Now, her life in the convent was highly regimented. Day began at 3 a.m. and ended at 8 p.m. There were eight offices, which were structured prayer services. Each day, they began with matins and ended with vespers. The cloister, the convent, was silent at all times, except during the eight offices of prayer. And so the nuns developed a sign language that allowed them to communicate with one another, a silent world in which she lived. There were about 40 or 50 nuns at Mary's Throne while Katie was there. Now, I've painted a fairly bleak picture so far, and really from our perspective it is bleak, but let's try to get back into the medieval mindset just for a moment, because even though she's at Mary's Throne, a lesser convent, Katie had achieved the ideal for medieval women, and that was life as a nun. They were respected for their hereditary social class, and they were honored for the religious service that they provided to the community. And this is Katie von Bora at age 23. She had achieved the highest status for medieval women. She was a nun. Now, there are many problems, but here's a problem I want to point out. She's in a silent cloister, and that means that Katie has almost no voice for us to hear. Almost all that survives from her are eight letters kept in a library somewhere in Germany. So everything that we know about her depends upon the words of others. I can't tell you her life in her own words until we get to the end. I can only tell you about her life and the circumstances in which she lived. Now, when Luther came to understand the gospel, justification by faith alone, and when he began to write about this discovery, his books found their way into even the most protected places. And somehow, several of his books made their way into Mary's Throne Convent and into the hands of some of the nuns, including one named Katie von Bora. Somehow, no one knows how, 12 of the nuns in the convent were able to communicate with Luther, and they asked him for help to flee from the convent. They viewed themselves as prisoners. No one knows how this happened. I think it would make a great movie, this story here. Rescue from Mary's Throne. That'd be the title. I don't know who would play Luther. Tom Cruise or someone. After careful planning, in a very dangerous and daring operation, I'm not kidding, these dozen nuns were taken out of the convent on the night before Easter in April 1523. They were smuggled out in a covered wagon containing empty fish barrels. And if they were caught, those who helped them, this was a capital crime. This was kidnapping. You'd be sentenced to death if you were caught doing this. That's why I say it's very dangerous. Of the 12, three of them returned to their families. But 2 days later, nine of the nuns arrived in Wittenberg, April the 6th, 1523. And the question was, what do you do with them now? And they became Luther's headache. Now, we've already hinted at this. The place of women in society was unpleasant. Generally, women had to have a protector or a guardian. That might be a father, it might be a husband, it might be mother superior in the convent. But there was no such thing as an independent woman. And here were nine of them, without marketable skills and without protector and without guardian. Their families did not want them. Now, monks who came out of monasteries could become pastors or professors, but that wasn't the case for nuns. So what do you do with them? Well, with hard work and with thoughtful care, Luther helped eight of the nine find places to go. Some of them married, others entered schools and hospitals as teachers, and one was left, guess who? Katie von Bora. She's 24 years old, and she's in a very unique position for a woman in 1523. She has no guardian. She's free to choose her own path. She's not subject to an arranged marriage. She could choose her own husband if she wanted, and she did. And she chose Hieronymus Baumgartner. I wish I was named Hieronymus Baumgartner. No, I'm glad I'm not. He was a student at the University of Wittenberg, but his wealthy family did not approve of the match, and so she was left alone. Luther tried to match her to a pastor, Gaspar Glatz, but she wasn't interested in him. Apparently, she responded to this attempt by stating that she wouldn't marry anyone but Luther or his friend Nicholas von Amstoft. Now, one wonders, was she joking or was she proposing? Well, Luther had not personally considered marriage, and the reason is he feared that on any day he might be captured and martyred. He didn't want to put a wife through that. So he, up to this point, had refused marriage. But his father was pushing him. His father wanted an heir. Martin was 42 years old and had disappointed his father by going to the monastery. Now that he was free, Dad said, "Get married." So he would, I quote, "anger the Pope and the devils by taking a wife who had been a nun." On June 13, 1525, Martin Luther married Katie von Bora in a civil ceremony. And 2 weeks later, June the 27th, the whole town celebrated at a reception. The date is still observed annually in Germany with huge festivals. In fact, the first time that Lynn and I went to Wittenberg in 2003, we went to Wittenberg on a Sunday. We worshiped in the church. We came out of the church and realized that we were within the gates, unexpectedly, of the Luther wedding festival that day. The whole town was given over to it. It was fascinating. It was a festival for Germans by Germans. It wasn't put on for tourists. And the whole town was full of people. There was a reenactment of the wedding. It was a big deal. Luther's a national hero. But think about this. Here is a former monk marrying a departed nun. And their enemies predicted the worst, that they would give birth to Antichrist. That was said. Roland Baton tells the story that some of the Roman Catholics said that Katie von Bora was no beauty and forced herself on Luther. But their friends rejoiced. And though Martin was 16 years older than Katie, and there was no romance at the start, their marriage would be a model for the world. You see, Katie had been the ideal medieval woman, a nun. But now she was to become the ideal Protestant woman, a wife and a mother. And you can really say that in a similar way to how Martin changed the world, so also did Katie by what she became. Think about this with me. Here's a forgotten difficulty. This was the slow and hesitant acceptance of pastors' wives. Before the Reformation, all priests were celibate. And so there were no pastors' wives in Europe, not one. None anywhere. The whole idea was brand new. And this created two immediate difficulties. First, for the people of the parish, how do they relate to these women? What is the position of the pastor's wife? Does she have any authority? And secondly, for the wives, how do they function? What were their responsibilities? There was no pattern to follow. No one to look up to. These women were trailblazers in something that was brand new. What should a pastor's family look like?
Now, technically, Luther was a professor, but his home functioned like a parsonage, and it became a model for others. It really was like a parsonage. Katie had to struggle with this, but she did a superb job in coming to grips with this new responsibility. The first order of business was to straighten out her husband. Well, the story goes that he hadn't changed. Now, that you know, they didn't have mattresses like we have. They couldn't go to Mattress Firm and buy a mattress. There was no Sealy and Serta and all the rest. They slept on straw. Martin hadn't changed his straw for a year. And it said that his bedclothes were filthy from sweat. Likewise, he had no sense of money. He gave away everything that he had. He took no publishing royalties. He had a minimal salary. He had multiple ailments, kidney stones, depression, indigestion. And Katie helped him overcome all of them. See, Katie had to help Martin grow up at age 42. He was the stereotypical bachelor. I mean, this woman had to face all kinds of problems. Then there was the household management. Some of you have been with us to Wittenberg, and you'll remember the castle churches on one end of town, where they lived, the Black Friars Cloister was on the other end of town. It was an old abbey that had been abandoned and left in poor condition. And so she had to manage fixing up the house and the barns and the fields. She had to come up with money. How do you fund the home, the family, and the guests? Because six children would come, though two of them died young. Their home became a boarding house for students, a gathering place for theologians, and a hotel for travelers from all over Europe. Frequently, there were 40 people to feed and to house. And once she set tables for 120 people in their home. It is a big place, but still, 120 people is a lot. Maybe from her days in the convent, she woke up at 4 every morning, and the nickname that was given to her was, she was the morning star of Wittenberg, because she was up so early. Her garden included peas, beans, turnips, cabbage, lettuce, cucumbers, and melons. There was an orchard with cherries, pears, apples, peaches, nuts, grapes, mulberries, and figs. From a brook near the cloister, she caught pike, trout, perch, and carp. She kept horses. And records from 1542 list 8 pigs, 5 cows, 9 calves, also chickens, pigeons, and geese. Are you tired yet? Yeah. Yeah. You getting a sense of what an amazing woman she was? Luther came to love and cherish her. He wrote her letters with titles such as Sir Doctor, My Lord, My Rib. The name Katie is very similar in sound to the German word for chain, which he used for her. She's my chain. The German word Herzliebe, beloved in my heart, or love of my life, was used by Luther to describe her. Galatians was his most loved epistle, and he called Galatians his Katie von Bora. She always was concerned about him, especially when he traveled, and he wrote to assure her that she could trust in the protection and power of God. In 1546, Martin was called to Eisleben, the town where he was born, so that he could resolve a dispute about mining rights. While he was there, he fell ill, and after a few days, he died. Katie was unable to be with him. His body was returned to Wittenberg, where he was buried in the castle church. Now, before Martin died, he knew that life for Katie and the children would be very difficult once he was gone. Widows in 1546 had virtually no rights, and they were subject to guardians. Martin took the extraordinary step of providing property and inheritance for her, but was overruled by the magistrates. They took it all away. She spent the next and final 6 years of her life in poverty, supported by the help of appreciative friends, especially the King of Denmark. 3 times she had to flee from Wittenberg. Once when it was invaded by the Roman Catholic army of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. The castle church where Luther was buried was destroyed. The officers of the army urged the emperor to exhume Luther's body and desecrate it by burning. Charles replied that he did not make war on dead men, and Martin's grave was left untouched. Katie returned later to Wittenberg, but fled again in 1552, seeking to avoid a particularly bad outbreak of the plague. During the journey, her wagon veered off the road, and she was seriously injured. She lived for 3 months, finally passing away on December the 20th, 1552. One of her contemporaries, a man named Balthazar Mentz, composed a poem about her life. And here's an English translation of that poem. "I am known as Katharina von Bora, born in the lands of Meissen, of an old and noble line, like my ancestors of the past, serving God in the Roman Empire with honor and glory. As I came of age, I accepted a life of virtue." By that he means she went into the convent. "I accepted a life of virtue while everyone was enamored with the Pope and his den of monks, and highly regarded were the nuns. I was sent to the cloister Nimschen. I observed there both honor and duty. I called to God and prayed day and night for the welfare of all Christendom. God heard me and was pleased. Dr. Luther, the courageous hero, was selected as my husband, to whom in a virtuous marriage, to whom I, in a virtuous marriage, bore 3 sons and daughters. I lived as a widow for 7 years after the death of my Lord. And in the lovely city of Torgau, my body was buried, awaiting the trumpet call when all the dead will rise. Then with my Lord," she means her husband, or this poet means her husband, "I shall sing and praise God eternally, and with those who are chosen, live joyfully eternally." Now, we must be careful and not make Katie Luther into the ideal woman that all should follow, because she had as many critics as she had supporters. And after Luther's death, many of his friends kept their distance from her. Certainly Martin loved her, but we only know her through the eyes of others. I said earlier that Katie has no voice for us to hear, except for the 8 letters that are kept in Germany. Almost everything we know about her depends on what others have said. In some ways, this means that we can't know her. We can only know about her. But there is one exception, and it is profound. The last words that she spoke before her death were recorded. And we may learn something about Katharina von Bora Luther from these words. She said, "I will cling to Christ like a burr on a cloak." As she faced a painful death at age 52, her faith in Christ sustained her. And the image is beautiful. She was the burr, the sinner, worthless in herself. Christ was the cloak, the protector, the cover, the one who gives warmth and sustains life. And like all those barbs which grasp onto the fibers of the wool cloak, barbs that can't be shaken off, Katie grasped onto Christ and would not let go. Here is the wife of the most famous man in Europe, not boasting in him, not boasting of her life with him, but holding on to her Savior. And so I won't ask you to be like the amazing Katie Luther, except in one way. Do you cling to Christ? Well, let's thank God for this 6-year-old girl and for the godly woman that she became.